We're taking stock of state politics with elected officials embarking on new chapters, sending signals of stepping back, others wanting to forcefully push out the top election official. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There was a longtime state senator, John Erpenbach, now not seeking a seventh term. There are other recent announcements, which isn't that unusual for this time of year. J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics, keeping tabs on all the changes and what they mean. You can join in. Are you concerned about your district that your elected officials are not seeking re-election? 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's make use of your long lens over time in chronicling state government. These resignations, these step backs and pursuits of different offices, higher offices, they're a normal occurrence this time of year. Why is that?
Well, it's time to figure out what you want to do. The window to circulate nomination papers opens in April. Mm-hmm. It closes in June. So the more time you give others notice that you're not going to run, they can kind of make their own plan. So it's about now we start seeing stuff like this. And over the, after the holidays, you'll see more. So it's not that crazy in that timeline. There are a couple of things I don't usually see, like leadership positions changing mid-session, but that's another topic.
Is there anything unusual about the quantity of them or the party affiliation this year in particular after pandemic year two?
Not yet. Last session, we had 20 lawmakers who began the 1920 session who announced they were either leaving for something else, running for another office, or just flat out retiring. And that didn't count Scott Fitzgerald, who won a seat in Congress and then resigned his seat. That also doesn't count incumbents who lost. The session before that, we had 20 people who started the session in those jobs, those elected positions, and decided to do something else. So we're nowhere near that yet. Mm-hmm. The question kind of is, where are we going to end up? Because we're right now, we've got Amy Loudenbeck as a Republican member of the Assembly from Clinton. She's running for Secretary of State. We've got two Democrats in the Assembly who'll be leaving to run for Lieutenant Governor, Sarah Rodriguez from Brookfield, David Bowen from Milwaukee. We've got John Erpenbach saying he's not going to seek re-election. Jeremy Thiesfeld, Republican from Fond du Lac. So we're not quite in the range we've seen before yet, but there's still time. And there are other moving pieces right now. There are a number of senators I'm watching kind of on a retirement watch list. Kathy Bernier, for example, Republican, who's kind of been a high-profile member of the Senate this session on election stuff. Mm-hmm. She's been flirting with leaving. Of course, she also tweeted yesterday that she's having second thoughts because she's being attacked by quote-unquote right-wingers. So maybe she's going to stick around after all. Hmm. But yeah, we'll see these moving pieces and how it all plays out in the coming months.
One moving piece last night, the U.S. Senate confirming Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett as ambassador to Luxembourg. Barrett has run the state's largest city for nearly 17 years. What will be his legacy as mayor?
Well, there are going to be a couple of things that people talk about. One, he brought the streetcar to Milwaukee, mm-hmm. And there are detractors about that. You have to talk about the Milwaukee Bucks, the new arena. Did Milwaukee really grow under his vision? There are parts of it that grew significantly, other parts that still struggled. So it's going to be a mixed bag in that regard. I mean, Barrett's going to be known, and people look at him as this really nice guy that everybody likes. The question has been, what's the bold vision from Tom Barrett for the city and what was going to be the next act in this term? And so people are kind of looking for that before he got nominated for ambassador, weren't sure what it was going to be. So, Milwaukee's got its issues. You can't say Tom Barrett created them. He maybe didn't fix all of them, but he, also saw some significant redevelopment of parts of the city that you go to Milwaukee now, it's a much different city than it was 20 years ago, just in how it's developed and around the arena, those kinds of places.
Barrett said in a video address last night after the vote, it was his dream to serve the city as he grew up there and serve it as mayor. And he also discussed next steps on for a special election.
I wanted to have this transfer occur in such a way that there would be a special election that would add no cost for the taxpayers. And I think the timing of this meets that this will allow the common council to meet and approve a special election that would coincide with the spring election.
Okay, so he's really trying to think about what comes next. What would you say there as to what will be the next steps?
So according to the City Election Commission, a vacancy has to occur by December 28th for the special election replacement to line up perfectly the spring election. So we have, they'd have a primary in February, the general in April. If the vacancy occurs after the 28th, you could still have the primary on the April ballot and the special election in May, but that would be an extra election and extra cost. So to Barrett's point, they've still got, you know, what, today's the 17th? Trying to do math in my head.
Do the math.
But they still got 11 days for them to get out the door and declare a vacancy and it all work out. So they've got plenty of time right now.
Who do you think will run to replace Barrett? What is on the table?
An easier question will be who will not run to replace Tom Barrett right now, because think about it. This job opens like once every 25 years on average. And I'm not really exaggerating either. He's been mayor for 17 years. Norquist was mayor for, what was it, 2 decades? I mean, like, Milwaukeeans don't kick out their mayors once they get in the door for the most part. So we know that Cavalier Johnson, who is the president of the city council, common council, he becomes acting mayor once there's a vacancy. He's always said he's going to run. Marina Dmitrovich, which is a member of the common council, she's going to run. Ernell Lucas, the sheriff, he's going to run. I mean, like Dan Reamer, who's a state lawmaker from Milwaukee, he's talked about running. And so what's interesting is the timing. So if you are a local official who would be seeking reelection to your local office on the April ballot, you have to make a decision. Do you want to give up that seat, which, you know, local politics, often those seats are safe, right? Because there aren't, mm-hmm. isn't many, much turnover. Do you want to give it up for a shot at mayor? For Reamer, for example, this is great news because he can run for mayor and not give up a seat in the legislature unless he were to win. It's a free pass for him. And that was one of the calculations people talked about, was if Barrett had stayed on, because this process of approving ambassadors and foreign service appointments for Biden has dragged on for a lot of cases. If it dragged on until the spring or summer and made a fall election, it would get all the local folks a free pass to run for mayor, whereas a Reamer had to give up the seat. So, you know, it's a choice for folks because it's a very, very safe job once you get it. But you have to take a risk to go for it.
J.R. Ross with us, editor of WisPolitics. He's with us as we talk about changing leadership, departures of Wisconsin elected officials, what it all means. With your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Let's go back inside the Capitol and talk about Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz stepping down from his leadership post in January. What do you make of that?
Gordon Hintz was not fully committed to running for election in 2020. In the end, he pulled the trigger and did it. But what he told me was that he committed to being leader basically through the budget and redistricting. So the budget was done this summer. Redistricting, we got on Wednesday, the maps were submitted to the Supreme Court from the various parties in that lawsuit before the justices. So it's out of their hands now and all before the Supreme Court. So he made it through those two things. And so he says now is the time to go because he's basically got two young kids. He's got a district up in Oshkosh, and he doesn't have, in his mind, a proper balance between his focus on Madison and running the caucus and Oshkosh and his district and his family. So this is about kind of reprioritizing things for him. And then he'll make a decision next year about, you know, seeking a 2-year term. That's kind of down the road a little bit.
It's interesting, too, that push and pull, wanting to be in your district, wanting to represent the people in your district, but really being pulled by all of the things that a minority leader has to do with their caucus in Madison. What is that tension there?
Oh, well, for one thing, it's a thankless job. I mean, because you're deep in the minority, and even with the new maps that we're going to get from the Supreme Court, barring a major miracle, there's not going to be a path to a majority for Democrats because the Supreme Court wants what's called a least change approach to the current maps, which means they want to use the maps that were approved by lawmakers 10 years ago as the foundation, make the least changes possible to account for population, and we're all done. So if you're not getting the majority, what's your job? Your job is to try to hold the majority accountable, you know, offer a different vision and try to find ways to raise money, which is a huge part of this job, to try and win as many seats as you can and not give up enough seats that there'd be a veto-proof majority for Republicans. It is a thankless task. You sometimes have to do a lot of hand-holding with members to, like, hear out their problems, be a shoulder to cry on. I mean, it's a whole mix of responsibilities that are outside of just policy and politics.
J.R. Ross with us, was politics editor. He's covered state government and politics for decades. What do you think are the most pivotal points in Wisconsin politics this year? Who is your, now play with us now, okay? Who is your time person of the year for state politics in Wisconsin? Huh? That's a good one. What elected official do you have your eye on for other offices? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with J.R. Ross here on the Ideas Network. We're taking stock of an Evers administration cabinet reshuffle and Wisconsin elected officials who've announced departures. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. By the way, do you think Senator Ron Johnson will seek re-election? What is your call? A slate of Democrats are lining up for the race, including Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski. Join in on the elected officials you're watching in 2022. It's 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross of WisPolitics with us for about five more minutes. So speaking of Senator Johnson, is it unusual for an incumbent to wait this long before announcing if they'll seek re-election?
Yeah, for the most part, but Ron Johnson is not the usual incumbent. I mean, Ron Johnson has always kind of marched his own drum. He looks at campaigns and says they take too long anymore. He thinks back to his 2010 race, where if you go back there, he was literally unknown until like the spring. He announced sometime in March or April he was going to run. He won the state party's endorsement at the May convention, and then his campaign took off. He thinks that's how it should work. That's not how it works for most people. He's a very unique figure in politics in that regard. He thinks campaigns cost too much. He thinks there's too much focus on consultants, what they have to say. He thinks it's all, quite frankly, BS. So he's doing what he does. He's taking his time, but the signs are pointing more toward him getting in than not. I reported a week ago that he has begun interviewing possible campaign managers and consultants for a bid. Now, I was cautioned by my sources that this is not a sign he's 100% in. This is a sign that he is preparing for a bid in case. And it could go either way. Ron Johnson is, again, unique, thinks his own way. But Republicans are putting pressure on him. They want to see him run for the most part because of power incumbency. It would avoid a messy primary, possibly. And they think he's got the best shot, even with all the drawbacks of a Johnson candidacy, because it looks like, as of right now, a pretty good Republican environment next year, maybe a great one. And that would maybe patch up any of the deficiencies he has as a candidate.
But if he does decide to run, what effect would his peddling COVID misinformation, the Listerine, all of that, what would that have on his reelection chances, do you think?
Excellent question, because we looked at the Marquette poll last time. He had very mediocre poll numbers. They asked people, do you trust Tony Evers and what he says about COVID? He had decent marks. Do you trust Ron Johnson? Didn't have decent marks. But does that drive the conversation next fall? That's what I don't know. How does that figure into, all right, is it all about Biden and his struggles in the White House? That would maybe paper over some of these issues, right? If it's a wave year, flawed candidates can win in wave years. That's been proven time and time again. So I just don't know how much that drives the vote for people. Then who's the alternative, right? Some Democrats would get Mandela Barnes, for example, and say, well, he's maybe too liberal in this environment. If it's a good Republican environment, do you want somebody more moderate? And I'm not picking on Mandela, just using an example of like, he's the front runner for the nomination. Is that the right profile to be a contrast to Johnson in a decent GOP environment? Maybe, maybe not. But those are all things. It's not just basically about Ron Johnson. It's also about Ron Johnson and who is the alternative Ron Johnson for voters next fall if Johnson runs.
Well, we'll be watching on that. Let's turn to the Evers administration, the cabinet. We learned that the State Department of Administration Secretary Joel Brennan leaving for a job as president of the Greater Milwaukee Committee. And, you know, DOA, Department of All, as they like to call it, it handles so many state functions. How big of a shakeup is that to have Brennan leave?
Well, it's not great timing because Governor Evers is going to run for election in, 10 months now, 11 months? It's going to be election. So you usually don't want to have a big cabinet shakeup at this point. But he's got Kathy Lumenfeld, who is the Department of Financial Institutions Secretary. She's going to move in to DOA spot, so that should be a fairly seamless transition. you know, cabinet members aren't normally really high profile people in general. So it's not like Joel Brennan was driving the train for Tony Evers as governor on policy decisions. But, you know, not to diminish, Joel's also a respected member of the cabinet, well-known in Milwaukee, been involved with policy and politics in Milwaukee for decades, very competent person in that job. It's just not great timing because you have to have a change now, just months out from election. The question, though, is, okay, I think Evers' issue is more about Joe Biden, the White House, the environment next fall he's going to face, questions about Evers' response to Kenosha and the violent protests there a year ago over Jacob Blake, how he handled the unemployment insurance program and how it struggled to fill claims during the pandemic. Those are probably bigger issues for him than who's in his cabinet, but just not a great time for change to happen.
JR, thank you for joining us.
Anytime.
JR Ross, editor at WisPolitics. The nearly 7,000 Afghan refugees living at Fort McCoy were introduced to an American holiday tradition last week. The Madison Ballet did four short performances of The Nutcracker for families. WPR's Courtney Everett was there to capture the excitement.
Dozens of Afghan parents and children sit inside a warehouse. Their eyes are drawn to the sugar plum fairy gliding across the stage in front of them. Some are even capturing the beauty with their cell phones. The performance was Jonathan Solari's idea. He's the CEO of the Madison Ballet. The idea came together in just 1 month. The joy around him reminded him of his time helping refugees in Greece in 2015 and 2016.
I had seen the families who were in this transitional space and how much joy engagement with simple arts and crafts brought them.
Solari called a friend with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in Maryland and shared his idea. Then a collaboration was formed.
There's Department of Homeland Security, the Department of State, the Department of Defense, the Army, the Fort McCoy workers. It's been exceptional.
30-year-old Mushkan Karimi is one of the refugees amazed by the live performance.
What I seen here, it was more than what I accepted. That was really amazing.
Unfortunately, she watched the performance without her family.
No one is here with me. I'm alone. My family is in Afghanistan. It's been stressful since I came here.
Karimi has been at Fort McCoy for 3 months. Her cell phone broke while she was trying to navigate the chaos at the Kabul airport. It took her a while to hear whether her parents were okay.
Sometimes I'm thinking about it. I wish I never come.
The performance is a welcomed break for Karimi from her stressful situation. Some children living at the base never had seen dance before and even got to try it before the afternoon performance.
Okay, now we're going to try something different. We're going to go.
That's Madison Ballet instructor Juan Carlos de las Velas. He's teaching the children different ballet techniques, including twists and leaps. A few of Atikula Amadze's children beamed while they danced. He lives on the base with his wife and 7 children.
And every morning when we wake up, we appreciate that and we thank God that we are here safe and secure with our families. And there's not enough words that I can say that how grateful we are for that.
He and his family boarded a plane at the Kabul airport with about 380 other refugees. Now, he hopes to find work.
All I will try to find a job and send my kids to school. And obviously, I have to go to work to put food for my family on the table and whatever they need, I'll do for them.
His story, like so many other refugees, holds onto hope. Sisters Ariana and Layla Zafari understand what it means to leave Afghanistan in hopes of a better future. Ariana is a board member with the Madison Ballet and explains their father's family fled Afghanistan decades ago.
My dad had to walk on foot for weeks to get from Afghanistan to Pakistan.
12-year-old Layla is an angel in the Nutcracker and hopes that the performance is an inspiration to refugee families.
I'm happy that I get to perform for them, and it's like a sign to tell them to don't stop following your dreams.
Although the performance had to end, it was a short escape into dreamland for the families as they pursue new lives here. Courtney Everett, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And stay with us. Ahead this hour, we examine the expected increase in heating costs this winter with the head of the nonprofit consumer advocacy organization, Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. We look at how to manage energy expenses in the winter. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a question about the holiday cocktail known as the Tom and Jerry.
Every season has its cocktails. In the summer, it's gin and tonic with a twist of lime, a margarita, or a Long Island iced tea. When the temperature drops and the snow piles up, people want a little more warmth, like a hot buttered rum or spiced mulled wine. During the holiday season, folks in Wisconsin turn to a hot drink known as the Tom and Jerry to warm them up. That got listener Pam Stokowski of Whitewater wondering.
Is Tom and Jerry's a Wisconsin thing?
We were intrigued and decided this topic needed some serious research. So we asked someone who has spent some time studying the cocktail.
Down on the corner, the crowd is so merry. I wind up by having about 12 Tom and Jerry.
Well, maybe someone who has a slightly more scholarly approach.
My name is Jim Drager. I wrote a book for the Wisconsin Historical Society called Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries.
We thought Drager might know if the Tom and Jerry is unique to Wisconsin and why that's so.
I think there are a couple of reasons why it's a Wisconsin thing. First of all, it's basically a farm-based drink because it has dairy and eggs in it and butter in it. So, you know, for us Wisconsinites, that hits home to that sweet spot in our heart for dairy. And I think the other reason is because it's a drink that has brandy in it. And as we all know, Wisconsin has a thing for brandy.
So we have a dairy connection and the Scotty favorite brandy. But did the Tom and Jerry originate here, or does it come from somewhere else?
There is an American mixologist named Jerry Thomas who claimed credit for it in the 1860s. He published a recipe for it in the first cocktail book written in the United States, but historians have demonstrated that was around before Jerry got his hands on it. There's actually a known origin for it. In the 1820s, a London playwright created the drink to popularize a play that he had written that had two characters named Tom and Jerry in them. And it just took off from that point and became popular.
The play was called Tom and Jerry, or Life in London, by William Moncrief. It was quite popular at the time, running for over 2 years in London before coming to America. The Domino Bar in Wausau specializes in making Tom and Jerry's, serving over 4,000 of the hot concoction between Thanksgiving and New Year. Bar owner Dan Bauer is not sure if the Tom and Jerry is a Wisconsin thing or not, but he does say,
I know they're very popular around here, especially when it gets cold. The colder it gets, the better it gets. Warms you up inside.
Bauer says the tradition of making Tom and Jerry's over the holidays started at the Domino sometime in the 80s and gets bigger every year. Bartender Donna Seidler put one together Domino style.
We have the bowl of the Tom and Jerry mix. We do a swoop and spoon of the top secret batter. And then we add a shot of dark rum and brandy. And we have to make sure the water is rapidly boiling. And as we pour that in the cup, give it a couple of stirs. It's nice and frothy on top. Top it off with some of the sprinkles. And that is a Tom and Jerry.
Lovely.
If you can't make it to the Domino during the holiday season, you can make Tom and Jerry's at home. Just don't forget to get a tub of batter from the market.
No, I didn't forget. The tree is up and the Tom and Jerry mix is in the refrigerator.
So gather around the fireplace with your family and friends, light the tree, and enjoy the season.
What do you have, lad?
Oh, whatever you're having, sir.
I'm having Tom and Jerry myself.
Special thanks to Rob Mentzer for his help with this piece. This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
And now to your rising energy bill. State regulators signed off on settlements last month with two of the state's largest utilities, Xcel Energy and Alliant. They are raising rates to cover costs associated with transitioning away from fossil fuels. Has your energy bill gone up? How do you keep heating costs in check in the winter months? Do you understand your bill and what it says? 800-642-1234. Tom Content is Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin, or CUB as it goes by. It's a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, we're seeing that the U.S. Energy Information Administration is forecasting that residential natural gas prices will definitely be on the rise this winter, Midwest experiencing the largest increase. What is going on?
Well, so many factors are contributing to higher costs this winter. And at CUB, what we do is we try to focus on the costs that we can control. And those are the costs that are actually regulated by the State Public Service Commission. But so much of what is happening right now is actually linked to the kind of the natural gas market's gone haywire. We had the comeback from the economy shutdown and the kind of that rubber band swing on the oil and gas industry led to higher prices. And then because the U.S. is actually now exporting more of its natural gas to Europe, we're seeing that when natural gas futures are traded, the higher prices in Europe are actually driving higher prices here. Hmm. And there's even another factor, which was, if you remember back to last winter in February, when Texas had those blackouts.
Yes.
Part of that was because they didn't properly winterize their electric system or their energy system, and the natural gas distribution and pipeline system down there actually froze up for a time. And that drove up prices of natural gas across the country, including here. And some of the increases that customers are experiencing this fall and are actually still linked to that February storm, so that it is a combination of things going on that make people want to actually reach for those Tom and Jerry's.
A nice tie in there. What do inflationary pressures have anything to do with this at all? Because we're seeing, you know, a huge spike in inflation, the largest 12-month increase since 1982. Does that have any influence on energy costs?
Yes. I mean, I think it's energy costs as a component of inflation that are really helping contribute to that to the higher prices we're seeing all over in a bunch of areas. We've been on energy in particular, things had been more stable for a time. The advent of fracking led to a big drop in natural gas prices. When I was covering this industry for the Journal Sentinel 10 years ago, natural gas prices were very volatile. And when fracking came on, that led to a big reduction. But the fracking companies weren't actually making enough money, so there was a big scale back on their part, and that ended up it's a combination of things, but it ended up there was less drilling and less activity going on, but the inflationary pressures are definitely being seen across the economy. But energy is certainly part of that.
Okay.
The good news is that energy, at least on the natural gas markets, that has moderated a little bit since in the last couple months.
So it's a mix of things going on. One thing I know you're really excited about, I have brought in my utility bill. It's right here in front of me. And we're going to take a little bit of a tour here through it that, you know, there's and really understanding what is in a bill, because there's the system connection and customer service charge, the distribution service charge, the administrative charge, the grid connection charge, the state low-income assistance fee charge, and then there's the actual energy itself charge. So help us understand, as we look at our bill, what it means.
Sure. So most of the bill is still on the electric side of your bill is still still influenced by the energy charge, beyond that there are these fixed charges. This is called the so-called customer charge, typical utility. It depends on the utility, but in Wisconsin, we've seen the fixed charges, the fixed portion of the bill go up over the last 10 years or so. At CUB, that's a concern for us, because we think more of the bill should be on the energy charge, because it when that happens, you have more power to actually get savings for yourself through taking steps to make your home more efficient. Whether if you want to add solar panels, if you have the ability to do that, there's more ability to control the bill when you have a lower fixed charge. And so those settlements with the Public Service Commission that just got approved, we're seeing the fixed charge come down for the first time in a long time. So that for a Madison customer of Madison Gas and Electric, for example, the fixed charge had gone up all the way up to $19 a month, the combination of some of those charges you're seeing. And then it'll come back down to $15 in the next couple of years. And the same thing with Xcel Energy, where their fixed charge will be dropping to $15 a month. And it's just a really good signal that for customers who want to really dive in and take control of their energy costs.
One thing I've noticed in recent years is really being able to compare with others, comparing your bill with the city at large you live in or with your neighbors, and it can get pretty down to the granular level. What can you say there when you choose to look at those comparisons online?
The comparisons are helpful, and every house is different. Some houses are insulated better than others. You know, if you live in a comfortable house, if your house is comfortable, it probably is because it's not leaking energy, right? And there are steps you can take to actually make sure it's not leaking energy. But I think there is that, you know, people do want to compare how they're doing with one another and see if you can.
We're,
you know,
curious,
you can
and competitive.
Some more savings. Well, exactly.
By nature. Maybe
it's use that fireplace a little more, and put on a sweater if things are getting tough or tight in the winter time. Just make sure you close that damper when it's done, because otherwise you'll leak some of that warm air right outside in the winter.
We're talking about energy prices with Tom Content, who leads CUB. That's a consumer watchdog group advocating for residential ratepayers and small businesses, giving them a voice before the Public Service Commission. How do you heat your home? Do you have questions about where you can go for energy assistance? Have you relied on assistance to get through a winter? What questions do you have about your options? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Tom Content here on the IDS Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kant. Thanks for being here. The U.S. Energy Information Administration says retail prices for energy are at or near multi-year highs. Are you seeing your utility bill go up? By how much compared to last year? Has spending more time at home in the pandemic with the lights on reflected in your bill as you look at historical costs? Join in on energy costs, what you see, 800-642-1234. Tom Content leads the work of the nonprofit organization CUB, the Citizens Utility Board, with us for about 9 more minutes. Tom, in the Census Bureau reported 29% of people surveyed have reported reducing or foregoing household expenses to pay an energy bill in the last year. What resources are available to help people pay their energy bills?
So that's a really good question, and that's something we're working on at the Public Service Commission, is trying to really zero in on affordability and household energy burden. And there are resources. The federal coronavirus-related stimulus bills have really been able to pump money into Wisconsin and help. Actually, the state has been able to send out over $100 million to help customers with their kind of back utility bills for during that period when the state wasn't allowing utilities to disconnect folks because of the public health emergency. But there are resources, and there's even a new, there's energy assistance programs as well as a new water assistance program for low-income utility customers. So if you're low-income, there is a website that you can go to actually apply for energy assistance, and I'm just going to say it. It's energybenefit.wi.gov, and that's kind of a portal to get started on getting energy assistance. And there's an 800 number, 800-506-5596, to access that. And then there, for those who maybe their income is just above the thresholds for what's defined as low income, there's also the Keep Wisconsin Warm Fund, which Kate, if you Google that, they have a website that provides assistance as well. And some of the utilities have their own programs as well.
So you have to do a little bit of research here, and then also the application process, because early on in the pandemic, there were people in need, and yet the dollars for those utility bills weren't getting to the families because there was so much red tape. Is that red tape kind of dissipated a bit?
I think it has. I think it has. For a lot of the utilities, the big utilities, the state was actually able to, through its IT system, was actually able to connect to the customers' accounts and reduce some of the unpaid balances.
Okay.
That were linked to the public health emergency, and then the utilities also went another step and in an agreement with our organization that the PSC approved, several of the utilities have launched forgiveness programs, so that if you're low income and basically there is a subset of customers that are having a tough time paying their bills, but if they can get back on the to paying even half of what their regular amount is, then they get the past due balances forgiven. And it's just another step to try to get people back on their feet.
What adaptations can people make to their homes? What changes can they make to their lifestyle to save on energy to lower those bills?
Sure. So, I mean, there are big fixes you can make. That's, you know, getting an energy that and making sure, I mean, the blocking and tackling of saving on energy and saving money is really insulation and air sealing. And LED bulbs is another big one. And there's a few resources that we'd point out for right now, because I know the price increases are happening right now, right?
Yes.
So one thing is that there are free light bulbs available to anybody, any utility customer in Wisconsin. The Focus on Energy program sends out free energy packs to anybody, any utility customer in Wisconsin. So if you go on focusonenergymarketplace.com, that's available. And then one of the newer features, new technology features that's helping people save money is these smart thermostats, mm-hmm. like the Google Nest or Ecobee. And Ecobee is now owned by a Wisconsin company, Generac. But what's interesting is that at the hub right now, there's a special promotion going on through Focus on Energy and the manufacturers. They're having essentially a holiday winter heating cost sale. Normally these things have cost $150 to $200, but right now you can get one as low as $5 or $30 on Focus on Energy. If you go to Focus on Energy right now, Focus on Energy Marketplace, it's an amazing savings that can enable and installing one and then following along.
Focus estimates it.
Exactly. Once you program it, it kind of links up with your smartphone and senses when what your patterns are, mm-hmm. In terms of energy use and when you're not there, and adjusts accordingly. And the average person can save $150. And at a time when you're seeing, you know, a couple $100 increase forecast for just on heating costs. This is a great time to go for
LED bulbs. It's a big return on investment.
Exactly. So a great time to go for LED bulbs and a smart thermostat.
Tom Content with us, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin, as we discuss energy bills, rising energy prices, what's behind them. You can join in with what you see on your bill, 800-642-1234. Tom, with the Public Service Commission regulating the state's public utilities, we've heard from public utilities in their statements saying, look, it's going to cost a lot to transition away from fossil fuels. We need to raise our rates. How do you balance that with, you know, putting it on the backs of your consumers versus what the utility can absorb?
Well, and the fact is the price of renewable energy of solar has dropped 90% over the last 5 to 10 years, it's actually the least expensive thing you can actually build if you're a utility now. The challenge is keeping this transition affordable, as you mentioned. Where we're working is trying to keep as they're shutting down coal plants to shift over. We're trying to reduce the cost of and make sure that customers aren't paying the tab for another generation on coal plants that are no longer needed and to keep the lights on. And so we've been able to reach agreements with We Energies, for instance, where they refinanced one of the costs linked to one of the coal plants that shut down a few years ago. And that helped save money. But it is a challenging time because Wisconsin's rates, electric rates, are among the highest in the Midwest and 13th highest in the country. And so there is a lot of pressure to, and so we, our regulatory team is at the Public Service Commission, and what they do is try to make sure that everything is justified in terms of the need, because one of the risks we have is overbuilding. Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin doesn't have a great planning process for how we do this transformation. So we're urging for a better planning process along the way to keep costs down for customers.
Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Content, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.